adoption of the agenda. If we could have a mover and a seconder for that. Dave and Greg, great. And all those in favor? Okay. It's adopted then. And the approval of the last minutes. There was something that seemed a little bit off to me, and that was the recommendations. It said from March 8th that Doug had submitted, but they were actually the ones from after the March 28th meeting. Maybe we can just take a look at that and just amend them if necessary. Does that make sense to you, Bernadette?
Yes, I think I was putting the date that they were submitted. I think I was like, if you're going to do a document and it has a date, that's the thing I was looking at.
Okay.
But yes,
It is confusing because we're pondering, we're getting the information, and then we're submitting something after the meeting, so it's delayed.
Yes.
In the processing, anyways, if that makes sense. So the approval of the minutes with the correct recommendations reflected under business arising. And do we have a mover for that, Greg? And a seconder? Someone?
I'm confused.
You're confused. I know, it's a bit confusing.
I mean, I'll catch up, but.
Yeah. And we can always get together, Karen, and just go over some of the process. I know we didn't have an opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, still looking. Thank you, Karen. Okay, and all in favor of adopting the minutes? Great. So those are adopted. Business arising from the minutes, that's kind of an ongoing thing. We're going to be having a list of recommendations that we will compile once we're through all of our objectives. And then number four is the recommendations from council. So for this meeting, the committee members will focus on objective 5, improve coordinated watershed management and planning. So I'm going to turn it over to Luke now, and you can take it from here.
Okay, thank you, Councillor Shipley. So as we just discussed, we've been going at this community climate adaptation plan for a while now, mm-hmm. and it's such a big document that we couldn't tackle it in a single meeting or even a few meetings, so we're spreading it out and covering one topic per meeting and coming up with some recommendations. One of them, which is improve coordinated watershed management and planning, when that came up in the context of the climate adaptation plan, our comment was, well, the RDN is really stick handling this at a regional level, and so it wouldn't be appropriate to have a discussion about watershed planning without the people that actually do watershed planning in our region. So that's where we invited you, and fortunately you're available for this one. So we didn't have a meeting last month because we wanted to have a discussion with you. So I think from here, I think if you could give a bit of a presentation about what the RDN is doing for watershed planning, and then I will facilitate a bit of a discussion, you know, and get some more input from the committee members as appropriate later on. So I'll turn it back to you, either Erica or Jessica, and you can take it from here, and then I'll take it later. Thanks.
Yeah, that sounds great. Here, let me share my screen and let me know what you guys can see here. Oh, can I do screen share here or no?
Give me just a second.
Yeah.
Should be okay now?
Okay, let me just try.
Give it the power.
There we go. Okay. Let's see here. All right, I haven't worked in Zoom in a little while, guys, so just give me a second here. Okay, can you see the beginning of the presentation here? There we go. Okay, well, thank you so much for having me here today, you guys. This is... Yeah, it's really nice to be included in on the conversation, and I don't know what your your previous knowledge is of the RDM's Drinking Water and Watershed Protection Program, so I thought I would just give a little bit of an overview of our program, you know, get into sort of the roots of it, some of the stuff that we do around stewardship and education, but I think what might be most applicable to developing your climate change adaptation strategy is looking at how we do monitoring in our region and some of the projects that's informing right now. And it links really well with a lot of the work that Jessica's doing as well. So I'll talk a little bit about what we do in DWWP, but then I'll hand it over to Jessica to kind of talk about where her programs kind of dovetail with our activities. So just a bit of an overview, and jump in if you have any questions at any point, folks. So the Drinking Water and Watershed Protection Program, it's a region-wide program. So we started in 2009 and were funded by an electorate sent to the 2008 referendum. So every citizen in our region pays a parcel tax once a year to fund our program, which actually gives us the ability to actually move forward with a lot of our objectives and goals. I'll just do a map here for you, just so you can kind of get a sense of sort of where we operate, because I think it's so important to really set the context for the geographical area that we work. It's very important. The physical landscape in our region really is our guiding framework. We all know that water doesn't conform to political boundaries. So we really think about working at a watershed scale when we work within the Drinking Water and Watershed Protection Program here. So our region is divided up into 7 different water regions, and these are basin scale delineations. This helps from a planning perspective because it's basically based on where water flows and connects across the landscape. I think that viewing our region in this way is really important. It highlights the cross-jurisdictional nature of water. Watersheds and aquifers, of course, they don't conform to jurisdictional and regulatory boundaries. So this puts the RDN as sort of the regional jurisdiction here, and our program in a really good position to act as a bit of a facilitator between these jurisdictions, create opportunities for collaboration, conversations to see water protection as and sustainability really as a regional focus. So the program itself is overseen by our technical advisory committee. Bob is on our committee. I'll be meeting with him this week when he comes to our meeting on Thursday. But the committee includes representatives, of course, from all of our municipalities, Island Health, CFO, professional hydrogeologists, Ministry of Environment, Transportation, Infrastructure. So it's really about being a nexus for conversation and collaboration and working across a bunch of these different agencies. Of course, this is all guided by our action plan. So that was updated in 2020, and it outlines those, you can see here, sorry, I'll go back, our visions and our mission for the program itself. So I'll just get into, basically the 3 pillars of our program. So I'll talk a little bit about this for everyone today, but it really includes education, science and planning, and that is all built on a foundation of collaboration. So we raise awareness about water issues, encourage water-wise behavior through our outreach programs, and that's really focused on anyone, any residents of the region, so focusing on rural, urban, kids, adults, long-time residents, newcomers. We live in a very diverse region. We also support stewardship activities by providing financial incentives for things like rainwater harvesting, wellhead upgrades, soil improvements on people's properties. We collect data via regional monitoring networks and build science-based understanding of our local resources. And then, of course, all of this really feeding this information into planning processes, policy advocacy, and then decision-making support. So that's why we're here today, to sort of assist in that in any way that we can. So just a little bit about our stewardship resources. So really our role in stewardship here is to liaise with our community volunteers and connect with the community and create those opportunities for volunteer networks. We also manage equipment and provide training on that equipment so that people on the ground can be collecting quality data for our databases. We do review and entry of that data that they collect, and we offer hub of communication stewardship actually at the watershed level. And of course, then feeding all of that information that our volunteers provide us with, we can do data analysis on it, engaging professionals for that, and then we can report out to the public and decision makers based on what we see happening on the ground. So then part of what we do as well, I did touch on it a little bit, just in terms of actually promoting some of the sort of water smart guidelines in our communities. We do have a large part of the funding in our program goes towards water smart rebates. So looking at rainwater harvesting, irrigation upgrades and soil improvements. We also offer rebates for wellhead upgrades and pay for 50% of well water testing as well if people are interested in understanding the water quality on their properties. You may recognize the Drinking Water and Watershed Protection Team as basically Team Water Smart when we're out in the community. I know that with COVID in the past couple of years, that hasn't been a big part of the public-facing focus, and we're really looking forward to the summer ahead as things kind of open up a little bit more and we can be boots on the ground and actually visiting the communities more. But we do go to community events, we hold workshops, we provide school programs, watershed tours, lots of outdoor events, and then also providing stewardship seed funding to stream keeper groups in the community that are doing active restoration on streams. So I just want to talk a little bit about some of our monitoring science and community partnerships that we have. I think that accessing some of the information that comes out of this type of monitoring could actually be quite useful in building your climate adaptation plan. So really in some ways the backbone of our programming is the science that we do. So I'll just go through some of the examples of these types of programs that we run, of course, through partnerships. And these contribute to long-term data that can inform restoration initiatives, can inform water planning, development planning, and then, you know, of course, for you folks, climate change strategies. So in terms of our well water testing, so to track groundwater levels across BC, the provincial government has an observation well network dedicated to ongoing monitoring. So groundwater level monitoring equipment in these wells collects information on the water table, basically whether it's declining, stable, or on the rise. Back in 2011, the Drinking Water and Watershed Protection Program partnered with the province, as well as I believe the Geological Survey of Canada, to expand its observation well network in our region, and now that monitoring network is up to about 35 wells, as you can see on the map here. In addition to that, to expand water level data collection, what we have kind of provided is observation wells from volunteers. So there's also, in addition to that, 28 private well owners who volunteer to have groundwater level monitoring equipment on their properties, and we oversee the loggers on these wells, and these loggers record hourly level data, which is then downloaded by our staff, I think 4 times a year. You'll notice on the map some of the coastal areas here. So 6 of these loggers actually measure saline intrusion, so saltwater intrusion into these wells. It's something that, you know, looking forward, when we talk about climate change and sea level rise, this is something we're likely to see more in the region, so we are currently tracking that, and that's something that we could always look into expanding. So just a little bit about our hydrometric and climate monitoring program. So back in 2015, this report was developed, a regional climate and hydrometric monitoring network scoping strategy. So looking at this is basically creating a framework for why we want to monitor, do climate monitoring. And it's broad, but, you know, it's many things like assessing available water supplies for future community planning, aiding with operational hydrology calculations, so we can do seasonal water supply forecasting, which is something we report out on for every summer, to better calculate design flood estimates, rainfall intensities, looking at flood protection, really important. Also to improve fire weather monitoring, so thinking about forestry operations, forest fire safety, And then all of this feeds into baseline monitoring for climate change impact assessment, of course. So out of that report, one of the key recommendations was actually looking at snowpack monitoring. This was the first priority to be addressed, and a climate monitoring station was installed on Mount Arrowsmith looking at snowpack up there. So upper elevation weather information on Mount Arrowsmith is actually very important for the Englishman River, French Creek, Little Qualicum River watershed. Most of the water in our systems is not snowpack driven. If you look across the province and in other water systems, you know, they're relying on snowpack as the primary mode of getting water resources, whereas our system is really, a lot of it is aquifer-based and then rainwater-based within some of our dams and catchment areas. But that being said, snowpack level monitoring is really important because it is the recharge on some of these big river systems that we have. The installation of this Arrowsmith station was completed in 2015. And then the first winter of operation was in the 2016-2017 winter season. This is intended to be a long-term station and build on this local data set. And all the data from this snowpack monitoring station is incorporated into the provincial network of snow survey stations. So there's quite a few of them across the province. So to talk a little bit about surface water quality as well, which is something that we spend a lot of time monitoring. So our community watershed monitoring network is a partnership between the regional district's drinking water and watershed protection program, partnering with the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change Strategy, also working in partnership with Mosaic Forest Management so we can access some of our sites. And then, of course, many amazing community watershed stewardship groups in our region, which are the kind of boots on the ground, actually, collecting the data as a part of the surface quality monitoring. These groups donate their time. You can see on the side of the map some of the names of the groups that are out there on the stream. They go out there. We do training sessions and help them calibrate their equipment, and they're out there collecting water quality data on the streams. The quality of the data that they get actually doesn't meet a provincial standard. So this all does feed into the provincial database, and the idea is to collect enough data to see watershed trends and raise watershed health awareness in local communities. So this program has been in operation for several years now, and the long-term objective is really to use all of these multiple years of data to determine which watersheds require more detailed monitoring. And then we can improve watershed management and also the system land use planning. I think right now, currently 41 streams are monitored by trained volunteers as a part of this particular program. So that's some of our science and data that we collect, but really what that all feeds into then is thinking about informing policy and supporting planning. So I'll just touch on sort of three of the projects that we are working on right now that directly relates to that, and then I'll hand it over to Jessica and talk about how her projects relate to this as well. We are definitely on you know, many teams, but kind of all of these things overlap. So first of all, to speak to our regional strategy for rainwater management, this strategy is very new, just endorsed by our board in March of this year. So we're kind of at a stage right now thinking about prioritizing recommendations found within the strategy and then where we're going to begin implementing it. But basically, the objectives of this strategy is to outline collaborative rainwater management in the region. So when we say rainwater, the common term is often stormwater is how people think about that, but when the strategy was put together, which was seen that we don't want to just focus on storm events, using the word rainwater as kind of a phrase to speak to that, because, it rains in this region almost year-round. It's not just storm events where we have to think about what's happening with that runoff on the surface of our communities. Through this strategy, we're hoping to coordinate actions across jurisdictions to maintain healthy watersheds in the context, of course, of climate change, land use pressures, and, of course, evolving best practices for rainwater management. And we want to provide a basis to update policies, standards, and bylaws to inform education and outreach, supporting grant applications for infrastructure upgrades and natural asset protection as well. So coming out of our rainwater management strategy is a project that we're currently working on, which is the watershed performance targets for rainwater management in French Creek. These performances, we're currently working on phase two of this project, but phase one of this project was completed in 2021, so last year. So looking at where performance targets were developed using a water balance methodology, basically. We engaged with consultants NHC to establish these performance targets, and they developed a hydrologic model in the French Creek water region using basically data over a 60-year period to simulate runoff under current pre-development and then also future land use scenarios. They also applied a climate change scenario to this project, and it, which of course showed an increase in precipitation through the fall and winter seasons and then a decrease through the summer seasons. We've just engaged NHC for the phase two of this project, where they're going to be looking at implementation, monitoring, and adaptive management. So putting together a plan that we can use in the community to think about how is rainwater managed. And the final project I'll kind of touch on here is the Fresh Creek Water Budget. So just kind of to give you a bit of a background about our water budget project, this is a three-phase project that started in 2013. So the first phase included all available data across the region and was put into a conceptual model of water supply and demand for aquifers and surface water courses. A relative stress ranking was created, which highlighted priority areas to advance into the next stages of the project. The phase two of this project focused on three priority areas. So the main areas that we kind of looked at were Nanuse, French Creek, and then the Cedar Yellow Point water regions. And that looked at expanding that data collection and then monitoring and filling gaps identified in those initial data sets. And we're currently in phase three of this project. And what that is seeing is we're building a numerical model for surface and groundwater. And that's intended to run basically scenarios to illustrate and quantify potential impacts of climate change, also land use and development changes, increased extraction, so we have more water users on the land, and that can act as a necessary tool for developing long-term water supply strategies. So Nanuse was the first region identified in this project, and we completed phase three in Nanuse in 2020. And so we're currently working to develop that phase three water budget for French Creek, and we're projected to have a final report for that in October of this year. So that's kind of where I'll stop and hand it over to Jessica. I hope I gave you a little bit of an overview of what we do at the DWWT. If anybody has any questions, please just jump in. I'm happy to speak more to anything that I've kind of shown you here quickly today.
Any questions for Erica before we move to Jessica? Okay, let's move on quickly before anyone changes their mind.
Okay, I'll just get the screen share up. Oh, can I get permission to screen share, please? Great. Ken, are you seeing the
presenter view?
Presenter view. Okay, I thought so. It's been a while since I've done a presentation in Zoom. Okay, I might have it set up now. Sorry. Okay, how is that? Good? Okay, sorry. I think I've had it down by now. So I'm going to touch on some RDN energy and sustainability watershed related projects. I'm the Climate Action and Technical Climate Action Coordinator for the Regional District of Nanaimo, and my portfolio touches both on the corporate emissions reduction projects and on community focused climate adaptation and mitigation work. So most of my projects, there is some overlap with drinking water and watershed protection, but most of my projects are in green building, emissions reductions, and risk reduction for our infrastructure within our corporate operations. We do outreach around green building and other adaptation and resilience building measures, and then every once in a while we overlap with drinking water and watershed protection. So I'm going to focus on the key areas of overlap between my program, which exists in the long-range planning, energy, and sustainability department, and the drinking water and watershed protection program. And both of these two recent projects have come out of work done by our Climate Action Technical Advisory Committee over the course of 2020 and 2021. The specific topics are getting a sense of the state of climate-informed water supply planning in the Regional District of Nanaimo, and then developing an inventory and roadmap for natural asset management so that we can better incorporate that within the existing RDN asset management approaches and do a better job of understanding where our natural assets lie and what their existing state is, in addition to what we need to do to maintain those services that they provide for us. And the Climate Action Technical Advisory Committee was a group comprised of 7 technical experts and 3 RDN board members who were tasked specifically with identifying high priority climate adaptation and mitigation actions within the Regional District of Nanaimo, taking a regional focus. So they looked at a whole number of different options and came away with 3 top recommendations, and one of which was getting a sense of what our current regional state is for climate-informed water supply planning. And some of the impetus of that came out of conversations that were cropping up across the regional district, where residents were aware that there was going to be impending changes to both water quality, quantity, and availability that are going to be brought about by climate change, but they had less of an understanding of how we were responding to some of those risks and integrating those into our water supply planning processes. So the Climate Action Technical Advisory provided a recommendation that the overarching goal is to ensure water supply resilience, including emergency backups under current and expected future climate scenarios, specifically for RDN water systems and on areas on private and areas on private wells. And that was their original goal, was to do a region-wide approach and try to take a regional approach to water supply planning. But the supply planning area is a bit more complex because there's a lot of localized planning. There's a lot of discrete aquifers and different water sources serving different areas. So it's quite a complex jurisdiction and geography in our area for the water supply planning process. So they decided, okay, let's focus on the RDN water systems. And then to try to get that regional picture, invite interested water supply planners, water supply purveyors to join the study. And the idea is to encourage a high quality climate informed water supply planning across all purveyors in the regional district of Nanaimo, and clear communication of how that planning is done to the public. And some areas do this really, really well already, but there's a wide diversity of different different programs across the region that don't all have similar capacities to some of the more well-developed areas. And overall, the idea is to get that regional picture of where are our strengths and weaknesses in supply planning and how we're bringing in future climate changes into that supply planning currently. So they recommended a body of work that was to start off with documenting the state of existing climate-informed supply planning across purveyors in the RDN and try to get a sense of what people are doing to accommodate climate change projections within their supply planning and where are the strengths and where are the weaknesses and can we take some of the strengths that areas that are doing this well, can we share those with the areas that maybe need a bit more support and understanding what they could be including in their supply planning and also how are they communicating that out to the public. So we're focusing on the RDN owned water systems and areas on private wells and then inviting purveyors and suppliers who wish to participate in the study. And we're starting that work. We should be making those invitations over the next week or two. And then out of that, so one of the other goals is to identify the areas where we might need to do some additional supply planning. And that arose out of an overarching concern that we are maybe, basically the question came down to, do we need to be building more hard infrastructure to service regional water demands that might be impending in the future? And there's there's pros and cons to hard infrastructure. We have some fantastic natural storage in the form of aquifers that does quite a good job already. So it's trying to really pull out where is there a need for additional hard infrastructure, water storage, given what we're seeing from climate change, and is that something we need in addition to the natural storage we have currently. And then the second goal is to make the RDN information easily accessible and understandable by the public and encourage other water purveyors to do the same. So providing materials that can communicate how we go about water supply planning and making those determinations of do we need additional hard infrastructure or are we better off to invest in aquifers and more distributed storage and water conservation initiatives. So the proposed project, again, it's open to all water purveyors, running April through September of 2022, and it starts off with developing a best practice guide for climate-informed water supply planning, and that's to be developed with feedback from our local purveyors and technical experts, and it's going to have a technical focus with the idea that we have a nice off-the-shelf climate-focused supply planning guide to support particularly some of the smaller purveyors in the area. And then that can be pointed to when there's public interest around how water supply planning is done. And then document the current status. So how well are people doing compared to that best practices guide? And where are those common areas that we might need to see improvement? And how can we support each other in making those improvements? And then lastly, it's to communicate the results, really having those available resources so the public can easily understand how supply planning works, what are the considerations that are brought in, and have greater confidence in the supply planning that's being done across the region. So supplementary to that, Climate Action's Technical Advisory Committee recommended an increased focus on protection of natural assets and the integration of natural asset management within our traditional asset management. So that's got some key tasks of developing a high-level regional inventory for the current state of our natural assets across the regional district. And it complements some of the existing work that has been done under drinking water and watershed protection program in the past, including the Butter Johnson Marsh Assessment and the Millstone River EAP. And ultimately, the idea, similar to the rainwater management program, is to develop supportive policy and decision-making tools that can be brought into land use planning and help us determine what we should be providing in terms of resources for maintenance of these natural assets so that they can continue to support our area. So that's also work that's happening over the next while. And those are the two main projects I wanted to cover. If you have any questions, happy to take them.
Any questions for Jessica? I see Anne has raised her hand.
Yeah, I just had a question about whether or not, as you said, the approach is yet to be defined, but whether you envision it being like a policy or whether you see it going into bylaws, like how would it be regulated or enforced, I guess my question would be.
I think it depends what you mean by if.
Well, overall, like the objectives or the plan.
Oh, I see. So the Climate Action Technical Advisory Plan recommendations as a whole?
Right. So the recommendations in order to make sure that they're followed up on.
Yeah, okay.
Would it just be a policy or would it be stronger?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. Our approach has been to essentially provide the business cases for these different actions and get the final recommendations from the committee and then have them immediately brought into the budget as part of that approval work. So we didn't create a plan and then look at implementation. We brought implementation tasks, detailed implementation tasks, specifically within to the plan so that you have the justification and the actions all brought in together. And part of the strategy around the plan was to really focus on manageable, high priority actions. So we went from a list of hundreds of actions that we could be doing to three top priority areas. And that allowed us to get the budget, really scope the staff resources, and make sure we had made a request of what we needed to do that action in a very short order. And that was a specific strategy to really make sure we weren't going to get caught up in the diversity of things that we can be doing in the climate action and adaptation sphere. So that's been quite successful for us because we got clear board direction on where we needed to go. It was backed up by expert recommendation. And then the budget that went with that.
Great.
Yeah, and one of the things that's included in the plan is key strategic supports. And one of those strategic supports is sort of the plan do check act model of continuous improvement and adaptive management. So the idea that we are reporting out on the plan project, plan progress, on an annual basis and really showing that public commitment that here's what we said we would do, here's where we are, and here's where we're headed, and here's the troubles we encountered along the way and how we're choosing to solve them. So that I actually have a report in prep that's going to outline that proposed reporting piece, which includes reporting to committee and then public-facing reporting as well. But that's just in draft right now, so we'll see what our board says.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Doug?
Yeah, hi, thank you. Two questions, I guess. These are both about specific to the aquifer, the Little Qualicum River aquifer, Town Qualicum Beach gets a lot of this water. And I'm not sure if this is a question for Erica or Jessica, and maybe Bob Weir would comment on it too. One's a very specific question. There's a gas station right on top of the aquifer in Little Qualicum, on the Little Qualicum floodplain. And every time I go by that, I think it's probably not likely to happen, but how catastrophic would that be if we had a fuel leak? Petroleum fuels got, you know, because this happens, underground storage of fuels at gas stations, they leak sometimes and then gets into the groundwater. It would be impossible to remedy on a multi-century time scale, I think. Am I wrong? Is that a hazard to have that land use on top of our floodplain where our well fields are that support our, a lot of our drinking water.
That sounds like a Bob question.
Yes, it's absolutely a hazard, and we actually maintain several monitoring wells between our well field and that gas station. And we have also sort of modeled the flow of water in the Little Qualicum River Delta. And the advantage for us is the flow is generally from the river towards our wells, past the gas station and to the waterfront. So the flow is favoring that not coming back to us. The only way that we could do that is if we overpumped our wells and reversed the direction of flow and pulled it back towards us. And that's why we monitor all the levels in there so we know what's happening with the phreatic service in the delta. And we regularly sample the test wells that exist between us and the gas station. We've asked, of course, the gas station, the fuel company, for records on the property, and they're unwilling to divulge. So we have made the assumption that there have been leaks and spills there in the past, and that hazard exists over there. And we're just trying to monitor and ensure that it doesn't come back at us.
All right, thank you. I mean, maybe it would be a good idea in the long term for the town to look at purchasing that business and being able to, remedy the situation more thoroughly and permanently. So the other question was, going from that very site-specific question to a much more broad one, I'm a retired forester and done a lot of work on sort of watershed level assessment on crownland forests, but I've always been struck by just how different the requirements are for watershed level management on private forest land versus crown forest land. We don't have, on crown forest land, we have the tools of the coastal watershed assessment procedure and all those kind of things that we, metrics that we use to look at watershed health that can be, are criteria that can be reflected in the requirements for management actions, like equivalent clear-cut area and road density and stuff like that. In the private managed forest land, there's simply no requirement to be aware of those things or to care about them, even if you are aware of them. So I wonder how does the RDN work with the private industrial forest land owners to deal with watershed level. I'm particularly interested in equivalent clear-cut area and road density as indicators of potential risk to watershed within managed forest landscapes, but maybe there's other stuff that you think would be interesting to think about too. So interested to know what you can say about that.
Yeah, I can jump in, Doug. I do appreciate that question because I think it's something that comes up a lot. Mosaic Forest Management does sit on our technical advisory committee, so they're aware of all the work that they do, and they work in partnership with us on a lot of projects. So, for example, allowing our community watershed monitoring network to access their land for a lot of that surface stream water quality monitoring. So we don't have, regulatory teeth to do anything, but what it really is about is building those partnerships. There are neighbors and they want to be good neighbors, and it is about kind of creating situations of, encouragement for basically how some of those watershed areas are managed. And I agree with you, it can be a challenge for sure, because there isn't the regulation there on private land that is the same as crown land in terms of how the forests are managed. But we do sit at the table together, and it's about kind of keeping an open conversation about how we can work together in managing these landscapes.
Okay. I have a question. So, obviously when we look at climate adaptation, and the goal is already set for us, that we're trying to improve our watershed planning process. But I'd love to hear your perspective, because another aspect of adaptation is identifying risks. So, in your opinion, what would you see as the biggest risk that we should be looking to mitigate through climate planning? Jessica, why don't you try that one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think for us, like, one of the biggest risks is those interface wildfires. the urban interface fires. So from a regional district perspective, we have a fair amount of exposure to that. So, and they have pretty very significant consequences, both in terms of risk to human life and property, and then in their increase in risk to terrain destabilization, et cetera, as we've seen in other areas of British Columbia. So I think the urban interface and wildfire risk is probably the most substantial one we're looking at.
Okay, what about in the world of watershed planning? I mean, like, do you have any specific areas you're concerned about in terms of the future of our watershed?
Eric, I'll pass that to you. I have some thoughts on that, but I'll let Eric go to you.
So, go ahead, Jessica. You can probably answer this question better than I can. I mean, I can think of a few things in terms of just, you know, we're looking at longer, hotter, drier summers, and so we have a decrease in those water resources. And, you know, we think about that overlap between, you know, high development in our communities, but then a lack of rainfall in the summer that, you know, creates the dry landscapes, but also, you know, we want watershed resiliency. We want our water resources to actually be able to support the populations that are living in our communities. And so that is a huge one, I think, looking at kind of how much water is actually entering into our aquifers and how much is being pulled out. So that kind of speaks into some of those water budget studies I touched on, because it is really about, you know, how much is going in, how much is coming out. And when we look at some of those climate change projections, you know, we are going to see higher rainfall in the winter, but the question is, like, are we actually collecting that water in an appropriate way? So that's why kind of all those projects I was speaking to, they do feed into each other, because in the way that we manage that rainfall in the winter, so it's not just, you know, rolling across the landscape on impervious surfaces, and we can actually, you know, maintain it and catch it in our aquifers, it does provide a lot of resiliency for us. So I think, yeah, I think that's kind of what you're asking, but yeah,
Jessica,
you want to add to that at all? Just jump in.
Yeah, I think on that topic, it's making sure while we're asking these questions of really understanding what are we currently doing and what's the existing state of knowledge, because there's some there has been a lot of work done on characterizing different water supplies and making sure that is like that water supply planning studies looking at is that it is meeting best practice, and we're looking at these risks in a comprehensive way that really makes sure that we're getting those future projections incorporated and understanding what our population projections are and bringing all of that into those models, and that we're communicating that out to the public so they understand, here's the evolving risk, here's how they're responding to that evolving risk. And that's I think managing that relationship with Mosaic and keeping it really productive and collaborative is going to be really important for the ongoing health of our watersheds. They own the vast majority of land that feeds our water supplies. And so they're an incredibly valuable partner in making sure those landscapes are properly managed. So, keeping a good productive relationship in place with them is really important.
Good, thank you. I see Doug. Do you have your hand raised again, or is that from before?
Sorry, that was from before.
Councilor Skipsy, and then I see Bob has his hand.
Sure. I just had a question about the monitoring of the snowpack. And if you've had enough data to make it valuable information, or any information on trends, or what that information has informed or told us so far about the future.
It hasn't been a long-term study so far, but, you know, we are seeing less snowpack every year. You know, it does go up and down a little bit, but based on kind of what we've seen just since the snowpack monitoring station has been installed, we are seeing that. And, you know, that aligns really well with all the climate model projections of what we're going to see in our upper watersheds. You know, these stations were established for long-term monitoring, so it will be very interesting as we kind of go out 10 years, 20 years in the future. But it's interesting what these monitoring stations also use, I didn't touch on it too much, but they use a sort of a snowpack monitoring pillow. So looking not just at sort of the depth of the snow, but in some ways, you know, the water weight equivalent of that snow that we're seeing falling on the mountaintops, which plays into it, you know, in these wet coastal regions, sort of what's the quality of that snow, and when it melts, how much of it is actually turning into useful water resources. And when you have these sort of, you know, just even thinking back to this winter where we had some deep freezes, but we also had some big, heavy rain events, and what does that actually do for the snow on the tops of those mountains? So, so far some data that we can kind of extrapolate into sort of the trends, but it still is fairly new. Yeah.
Well, two things. One is that the work that's being done by Dr. Bill Floyd, I think that little documentary that was done for the Mount Aerosmith Biosphere was really good with looking at the kind of the work he does. It was very informative. And he spoke generally to, I think, some of the trends that we could see. And I thought that was really, really good stuff to get people thinking about, you know, how we're going to have to behave and change in the future. So that was just one point. I just wanted to bring up to Doug's questions about Mosaic. Yeah, like, not only do they sort of engage with the DWWP, but they also maintain regular water purveyor meetings with us, Arrowsmith Water Service and the Englishman River Water Service. And a couple times a year, we meet with them. They talk in detail about their activities, you know, issues that concern us, road deactivation, sedimentation, things. They show us their planned production and planning sites, any fertilization that might be doing, how they're monitoring it, what impact it might have on us. And they do discuss their, you know, their harvest, you know, the stats that they have to meet. And I think generally they are trying to maintain levels for non-public held forest land. They're trying to sort of like achieve and earn sustainability status and credits. I don't necessarily understand all of it, but like they do a pretty good job of keeping us informed, and we regularly go out with them and look at various points in the watershed. So I mean they're being good stewards of a community water system watershed in my view.
Well, it's interesting we've talked a bit about Mosaic because the first action, if you actually look on the Objective 5, the first action was protecting forested lands and environmentally sensitive areas to provide ecosystem service benefits, biodiversity, watershed, aquifer protection. So, you know, the kind of highlights that you've identified, Bob, and Erica and Jessica, you know, I think it's kind of reflected on the first priority in the watershed section of the plan. And earlier, Jessica, you also mentioned the, you know, asset management side of things, and that's actually the second action is trying to quantify or produce some valuations for local watersheds and those types of natural assets. So I don't know how much the RDN is investing into that. I mean, it's something that we're talking more about at the local level. It's hard to quantify, obviously, you know, but it's also, we've learned from those hard infrastructure projects in other jurisdictions that those are astronomical in cost. So it seems like a lot of these natural assets that provide, you know, natural storage, et cetera, have huge values. So.
Yeah, and there is that'll be part of what we're looking at. I'm not sure if it'll match the scale that you're interested in, but it's certainly an area that we're aiming to develop over the next few years, is understand more of that valuation of the services provided by those natural assets, either through replacement costs, like, okay, we've lost this resource, what does it cost us to replace it? And therefore, it informs also what should we be investing in helping protect that asset, where should we be putting our efforts, and are there particular locations in the land use planning spectrum where we should be applying more regulation because it's justified by the increased financial impact we would see to service delivery if that area got compromised. For example, an area where you have a particularly vulnerable aquifer, maybe putting in additional protection measures there, and you just build that regulatory case with an additional financial piece. My personal opinion is that there's often a lot of, we already have a lot of valuation, personal care for natural assets, and people like to protect forests, they like to clean water, and the financial piece of it, it brings it, you have an additional piece of argument and information that you can use to inform your level of investment and justify putting resources into specific areas. So it gives you a bit more information with which to make decisions on how, where you're putting your efforts across your assets. And there's the Municipal Natural Asset Management Initiative, which publishes guidance on things like working with private lands in the context of municipal natural asset management. So how do you approach someone like Mosaic, who is a very large private land holder, really valuable partner, and how do you manage that relationship from a natural asset management perspective? Because we can't necessarily put their assets on our ledger, right, because we're a local government. So how do you work those public relationships?
I didn't really thought about that from the perspective that, you know, you can't put that on your ledger. And I agree you can't. But do you value it still?
It's early days yet for us.
Yeah.
So it's lots of questions I think are being asked like this across a number of different local governments who are starting to engage in this, and they're working on publication for the accountancy side of this to formalize how we approach natural assets within the formal accounting systems that are used in public governance. So there's progress being made on multiple areas to advance this and provide a set of professional standards that people like engineers or accountants can look towards. And I think there's going to be a lot more formalization of these approaches over the next 4 or 5 years or so.
Well, that's great. Does anyone have any more questions? Doug?
I'm sorry, I should just keep my mouth shut. But, yeah, I really appreciate what you were saying about the relationship with Mosaic. And for me, it's complex to think about. You know, I understand that there's lots of great people working there who will come to the table and be very, try really hard to be as good stewards of the land. It's also true that they're operating on stolen land that was stolen in an egregious act of racism, the belief that First Nations people are not human, therefore they can't own land. So therefore, when 800,000 hectares of land was transferred to the Dunsmuirs more than 100 years ago, the justification was that First Nations didn't have ownership of land, therefore it was impossible that they were the owners. So I know this has nothing to do with climate change, really, but it is sort of, you know, to do with climate change that we have an industrial owner. A lot of people don't understand that private forest management is very different from crown forest management. On crown forests, you have an allowable annual cut that's supposed to be sustainable. That's not a requirement on private land. And Mosaic is cutting that land base at something like twice the rate at which it will be sustained in the long term. They're going to have a huge fall down of timber supply from that, and a landscape of very, very young plantations that will not support the kind of industry we have and will not have the same hydrologic properties that we associate with a mature forest landscape. That's a decision that's made in head office. That's not the people that you talk to who are trying really hard to be good stewards of the land. All that being said, managed forest land is a lot better way of managing watersheds than suburbs and shopping malls and golf courses and all those other uses to which, you know, we're seeing creeping as our communities grow, sort of creeping higher up the hills and into the watersheds too. So a long-term strategy for maintaining watershed integrity here is to keep those lands in forest land. And my hope would be that the government of British Columbia would buy that land back. That would probably cost, I don't know, $10, $20 billion. But the land was stolen from as I said, from First Nations on the basis of belief that Indigenous people are not human. And we have a moral obligation to buy it back and give it back to the people who own it. When you deal with reconciliation in landscapes where there's a lot of crown land, the government, they say, okay, we'll co-manage this and actually return large areas to you. But when this particular landscape on the east coast of Vancouver Island, where it was all privatized, there really is no crown land to speak of, reconciliation is impossible in that landscape as things stand, because there is no land to return to its proper owners other than private land, and so it has to be bought back. I'm sorry, I'm going way beyond what we're talking about here, but these are the thoughts that come to mind when we talk about that managed forest landscape that's in private industrial forest management for me.
Okay, I think we should probably cut our guests free. So it's been a pleasure having you with us. I'm sure everyone has a lot to think about. I don't think we're going to be able to turn this around and, you know, process any recommendations quickly coming out of this. But Erica and Jessica, I appreciate your time, and I hope you stay in touch on this project.
Thanks very nice. Thanks very much. It's really nice to meet all of you.
Good. Take care.
Yeah, thanks for having us, you guys. And get in touch if you have any more questions. Happy to pass along resources if they're needed.
Excellent. Okay, Councillor Skipsy, do you want to take controls again, or do you want me to?
Sure. I'd like to know if there's anything else you wanted to mention about what has been done. I noticed there was quite a few things in under Objective 5.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know if anything needed further explanation that some of the committee members might appreciate hearing more.
Well, if there's anything in particular, then by all means, Bob and or I can answer probably most of them. I was just telling hands still up from before, or you just, okay. Because he always has a lot of questions, so I figured he's always got another question.
Well, on page 43 of the Climate Change Adaptation Plan, it talks about aquatic habitat development permits.
Mm-hmm.
Wording that will increase regulatory flexibility for land use adjacent to greenways. Also talks about monitoring the aquifer health, which Bob spoke to briefly
mm-hmm.
earlier. The Little Qualicum River watershed or water management plan, a feasibility study. I don't know much about that. The 2013 Qualicum Beach Greenways study. Not sure exactly where that overlap is. And then the Regional District of Nanaimo's Team Water Smart. So that's basically the presentation that we just had.
Sure. Well, Bob, I don't know if you can add to that Little Qualicum River Water Management Plan feasibility study. I'm not familiar with that one. Do you know what that is, Bob?
Well, it's theirs. I don't think that we've got too much detail. We'll wait and see what they propose. We have a very, very good understanding of like what goes on in the Little Qualicum. And the storage has been developed and maintained on Karen Lake now by fisheries. It suits our extraction of water from the Little Qualicum Delta, almost perfectly. And I think it's been as a result of what they've learned, at releasing water daily from Englishman and the improvement to the habitat in the Englishman River and the restoration of some of the fish populations there, that they're doing with exactly the same thing in the Little Qualicum. So the Little Qualicum appears to be healthy from a fish point of view, but that extra water and really in the summertime also suits the municipal withdrawals in the well field. So we'll see what else they've got in the study, but I haven't seen a lot of details on it yet.
Okay. And then on the other one, the Green Laneways project, I see it's mislabeled there. The 2013 should be Green Laneways project. And that was identified in the context of watershed management, because the Green Laneways was in many ways all about getting water, you know, into retention basins, swales, you know, things like that allow it to get back into the ground, as opposed to
directly into the storm network and out. So that's why that was in there. And were there any other specific questions about some of the action items there?
I didn't have any more. I don't know if any of the committee members have any questions or anything that's come up so far today. Anything you want to comment on? Or I guess, like, you will do what we've done after the last couple of meetings is go away and kind of process information. And if there's any thoughts you have, you want to share with the other members, any recommendations that you would like to see go forward to council regarding the watershed management, then we could share those.
Yeah, and to give a little more clarity, like, you know, just remember that the purpose is to improve this plan, right? You know, we're trying to come up with the best climate change adaptation plan possible. So when we're looking at watershed management, are we missing anything, you know, in terms of climate adaptation? So, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of things that you think of when you think of how could we manage our watersheds better. But that's not exactly the question for today. So like Councilor Skipsy said, if you go away, think a little bit about how we can improve this section on watershed management to identify any missing points, you know, write it up, and we can take that next time and integrate it into our future discussions.
Yeah, and I think we're really trying to identify the areas that need prioritization.
Yeah.
That's what we're, because just like they said, you know, there's so many things that you could be doing, but they narrowed it down to three,
mm-hmm.
right? So we probably won't get there, but I think it makes it a lot easier to have those specific priorities going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we'll just leave that and we'll ponder and communicate. Status, number five, status of recommendations to council. There's nothing there. New business. I was just going to raise, I sent it out to the committee members that the urban forest management plan is slated to be on the next regular council agenda. And that is one of the objectives of the climate change adaptation plan. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts about that. I guess it's on for council to adopt or to review, and then do we have a plan? You're going to probably do a report.
Yeah, that's right. So we have a report written for the next council meeting on May 18th. The recommendation is that the council receives the report, and then there's going to be some action items recommended out of that. So we'll probably have more work for this group. Not to get my hand, but I think you may get it's something referred back to you at some point. But I also wanted to mention is that plan is up on the website, because I didn't want to just include it on the council agenda and make everyone read the 90-page document in the 5 days before the council meeting. So it is on the website now. If you go under town projects and under tree and vegetation management plan, then the up-to-date urban forest master plan is there for review. And it also has the changes highlighted since the last time we've looked at it, so you can kind of see some of the comments reflected in that update.
Luke, do you think it would be appropriate for the committee to make any recommendations or comments about this to council?
About the plan, the urban forest master plan?
Yeah, just a bit about, you know, the committee was tasked to do this work, and
Well, they did. I mean, we had that whole, the workshop, and the consultant got all the recommendations, and then incorporated them into the plan, made a bunch of edits and whatnot. So I don't think that they, unless council were referring it again to this group, I think we should start thinking about action items and not, you know, refining the plan anymore. I think it's a good plan. You need to start doing things.
Oh. Doug? You want to jump in there?
Yeah, Luke, I think maybe what Councillor Skipsey was meaning was, would it be appropriate for the committee, or would it be in place for the committee to communicate to council that that we hope that they'll adopt it? Maybe they've already made up their mind that they're going to, I don't know. We don't need to say anything. I guess the point is that we've worked on it long and hard for years and years, and we did our best to help shape and inform what council asked us. It was more than 5 years ago council first asked us to work on this, and we did, and put a lot of work into it. So would it be out of place for us to say to council, we think it's good and you should adopt it, or is that, I don't know. I'm not sure if we should or not.
Well, I think if you were to read it individually and have be inspired to write to council, then you shouldn't hold back. I mean, I think at this point, the group can't make a motion because you haven't read the last update or been a little preemptive. But I think council would respect each of your opinions as, you know, members of the community in terms of saying, yes, you know, let's get on with it. So I don't think that would be out of place, and I apologize. I didn't quite understand Councillor Skip's question earlier.
Well, I was putting words in her mouth. Maybe that's not what she meant. Okay, so this new version is a little different from what we saw last time, but would you say it more or less, like, we asked for a few changes to be made and said, don't bring it back to us, just take it straight to council, because let's get on with it. So,
yeah, it's 95% the same, right? It's just some little wording changes that reflect some of your comments.
Right, okay, good. That's great. So your thought, to summarize, is we can individually look at it on the website, and if we like, we can write letters to council saying that, you know, we think it does what you asked us to do and reflects the values of the community, whatever we want to say, and then we encourage them to what are they going to do? Are they going to adopt it? Is that the correct word, or?
We've done different things with reports. Council's received them. Uh-huh. They've adopted different reports. The challenge of this one, and I wrestled a bit with it writing the memo, is that there's probably, you know, 100 things that the report says we should do. And I don't want to get bogged down in terms of, you know, a member of council saying, well, I don't want to adopt the plan because I don't want to do that action 17C on page 49, right?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of favoring the receiving the report and then developing an action plan from it, as opposed to saying we adopt that specific plan. But, you know, I'm open to meet your recommendations on that, and council will ultimately make up their own mind as to how they want to handle it. But the RDM receives the report. They don't adopt any reports. The town has adopted some reports and received others. So potato, potato, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, so we could leave that out altogether and just say we hope that you'll move forward with implementing the recommendations, you know, within reasonably determined priorities. Obviously, they can't all be implemented overnight. That's the key thing, though, to go ahead with doing some of the key actions in it, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you for that discussion.
Thank you. Is there any other items of new business that has anything? No. Okay, and then future agenda items and discussion. I think, Luke, when we had gone through, the next one would be objective 6, and that's water conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Does that
that's
sound
right?
So that would be the topic for our next meeting on May the 30th.
That's correct.
Okay. And if there's any information that needs to be circulated ahead of time, that would probably be helpful so people can do their homework. And
yeah, good. Bob, do we have any resources that, you know, explain what the town does for water management? Like maybe the annual report, does that have some good water stuff for people to think about?
I don't think the annual report has as much stuff as maybe some of the presentations that I've made to council, you know, maybe any more on other issues. Like we put together a bunch of information before the Sandheim decision was made, and it looks at, you know, like per capita production over time and various other things. And, you know, we're seeing reductions, I think for a variety of reasons. Maybe I should try and pull some of that stuff together. Just, you know, some quick graphics and just have a look at the numbers, see what they say.
Sure. So maybe we can put a little bit of an overview presentation together that Bob's done before and do that at the start of next meeting.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay.
Good. And then there were some conservation things that the RDN did. I don't know, maybe if there's a link or something to that information, we could circulate that ahead.
Bob, are they on watering restrictions yet, the RDN?
They are. They went to stage two, I think, May 1st. We mm-hmm. go to stage one on May 15th by our bylaw. You know, like I don't necessarily agree with their just sort of knee-jerk reaction. You know, we go to this on this date when, you know, the climate hasn't really, or like, you know, our weather hasn't changed. And it drives me crazy that they go to the restrictions where they put it on, like, you know, 10 in the morning till this time or whatever. Like, you shouldn't overlap in-house water consumption with outdoor water consumption. You should separate them. That's my first rant on water conservation.
Don't spoil it all, Bob. You can save some rants for next time.
That'll be a discussion next.
That's great. So, yeah, maybe we can find some of the watering restriction information to have available.
The best stuff that they do is some of their educational material. They'll come up and do an audit on your irrigation system and teach you how to run it and how to better set it up. Like those are the things that are really, really useful.
We can't wait for next time, Bob. This is going to be fun.
Okay. Well, I think that's a wrap. Unless anybody has anything else burning questions. We didn't really hear from many people today. But,
I think we should call Doug a nickname, Doug Handwood, because he just like always wants to leave it up there.
Yeah.
Well, I was glad to hear you ranting, so it wasn't only me ranting.
Okay, good. So immediate motion to adjourn.
Lena, go for it.
Okay. All right. Put my hand down. Lena, go.
Okay, so Lena.
You're in the record.
Moved by Lena and seconded by Doug. And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Goodbye, everyone. Good to see you.
All right.